Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome, everybody, to Nightlight. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us. We really appreciate it. I hope that today's show is going to be an eye-opener for a lot of you, but before we get into that, I want to thank very much Ken Quiet Hawk for his amazing introduction. You can find he and his wife, Deborah, on a number of CDs that utilize the Native American storytelling to protect history and to enlighten anyone who listens to them, so do check it out, please. Tonight, we have an amazing guest, and I am hopeful that this will not be the only show I do with him. We welcome Tobias Churchin to share with us his book, Aleister Crowley in India, The Secret Influence of Eastern Mysticism on Magic and the Occult. For those of you who have already heard some negative rumors about this man, it's about time that somebody shed some light upon them. This book shares excerpts from Crowley's unpublished diaries and details his travels in India, Burma, and Sri Lanka from 1901 to 1906. It reveals how Crowley incorporated what he learned in India. I'm going to mispronounce words here, so please bear with me. Jnana Yoga, Vedantist, Tantric and Buddhist philosophy into his own school of magic. He explores the world of theosophy, yogis, Hindu traditions, and the first Buddhist Sangha to the West, as well as the first pioneering expeditions to K2 and the third highest mountain in Tibet in 1901 and 1905. Early in his life, Aleister Crowley's disassociation from fundamentalist Christianity led him towards esoteric and magical spirituality. In 1901, he made the first of three voyages to the Indian subcontinent, searching for deeper knowledge and experience. His religious and magical system, Thelma, shows clear influence of his thorough experimental absorption in Indian mystical practices. And just a short bit about Tobias. Having completed his 23rd book commission, and there's more by now, Tobias is today internationally recognized for his insightful books on esoteric spiritual history, art, and philosophy. Accessible and scholarly, his works address believers and doubters alike and remarkably have simulated spiritual experiences in some readers. He successfully widened the appeal of so-called esoteric spirituality. His warm style and depth of knowledge have entertained many thousands of readers in the process. He's also a filmmaker, lecturer, poet, and musician. An amazing man who has written about another amazing man. And I welcome you to the show, Tobias. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Barbara. Pleased to join you on this journey.
Well, this is probably for me an enlightening journey as well, because, of course, I had heard rumors about Aleister Crowley and thought, oh, my goodness, this is going to be quite an adventure. And it turned out to be an amazing adventure. I ended up, after reading the book, respecting him greatly for a lot of the work that he did in his journey for Gnosis, for enlightenment, for knowledge, for wisdom. And today, so many people are on that same kind of journey. And your book was fascinating in that he did many things that all of us wish we had had the time and the energy to do, because he had a rather nice background, so he was able to finance a lot of his studies and his journeys to a degree that not most of us have been able to. He was able to, follow in Blavatsky's footsteps. He was, I believe, a member of the Theosophic Society, the Golden Dawn Society, and then, of course, his own that he studied, that was a ways of attaining a blending with the cosmic energy, I guess, the creation, with blending with creation, would you put it that way? I'm not sure what he exactly was seeking, but I think a lot of us are on the same kind of journey.
I think you could say cosmic consciousness, certainly. His whole system is based on maximizing the potential of the individual to gain greater intelligence than would be if one didn't bother with that path. So it's really about expanding the mind to greater and greater awareness. And that was always the goal of esotericism. You're trying to turn the lead of ordinary human experience into the gold of spiritual awareness and practical ability. So it can work depending on what your particular gifts are. If you're going to be a mathematician, his system will give you, I think, if you follow it, you'll get sharper intelligence and greater imaginative potential in that field. But also, if you're going to be an architect or a cook or whatever it is you're going to do, it's all about expanding the potential of the human being to reach what he would call their true will, as opposed to the ordinary ego consciousness, which is regarded as a rather small thing, which we mistake for the higher thing. And that's one of the messages.
Yeah, it is. It is annoying from time to time. I think one of the major stumbling blocks for a lot of people is, the definition of words changes as the frame of reference of society shifts and grows, hopefully. And he spoke of magic, and most people interpret that as black magic. And yet, in reading the book, I began to realize that his understanding of the word magic was very different.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's very important to understand what he meant by magic. His idea of magic is that of the ancient magi. I mean, we just had Christmas, and everyone's heard of the Magi who come to worship Jesus as a baby in Bethlehem. And this idea of the Magi were people who were exceptionally knowledgeable, and the word applies to a tribe of ancient Iran associated with the Zoroastrian religion, who were knowledgeable about science and astronomy and those things which many of the things I suspect we've forgotten now. So when he talked about magic, he was talking about an ancient approach to the universe. He was not talking about what is familiarly called black magic, which is in some ways is a perversion of all kinds of knowledge. So I would say, he would say that science is successful magic. When magic is most successful, it becomes science. Everything we do in science today started as magic, including arithmetic, algebra, and all these arts of number and assessing quantity and reality were originally spheres of magic. When they reach a point of rationalization and repeatability, demonstrability, the magic becomes science. So what Crowley's interested in, if you like, is how to get the inspirational value into a form of knowledge. So he called his system, he defined it as the aim of religion, the method of science, which is a fascinating way of approaching this subject. And immediately mm-hmm. takes us away from our modern conflict we have between religion and science. People choose one side or the other, or get confused in between. But Crowley's system is to push the inspirational level of human beings to a point where it's true knowledge. And to help him do that, he had great experience in what is called Jnana Yoga. Jnana Yoga is spiritual consciousness yoga. It's about form of knowledge, spiritual knowledge. And the yoga that he was interested in, yoga means union with the highest potential of man, some call God. The highest potential is what you're aiming at. So his magic is, you could call it self-realization. But the trouble with using words like self is most people cannot separate the notion of self from their ordinary day-to-day conditioned awareness. The idea of the self in true magic is something you're going towards. It exists on another dimension, in fact. We in the material world are something of a projection of a spiritual reality. So it's connecting this world and the greater cosmos. And the cosmos is understood as a projection of mind. Sorry, I'm going in too fast, aren't I? Sorry.
No. It makes perfect sense. And so what you're explaining is exactly what people are looking for today. And
I think so. Yes.
and what the thing that I got out of a lot of it is that it is a personal, unique journey that you can be given tools, but the journey, how you use those tools will determine what it is that you gather and maybe actually what it is you're actually seeking, because everybody is different and unique. And
yes, I think that's true. Could I just come in there and say, you know,
yes.
People today argue about whether people are equal or not. You know, some will say, well nobody's equal. And some will say, no, everybody is equal. Everybody's equal. Look, the fact is everybody's different. So the equality thing doesn't even come into it. You know, it's not that people are unequal or equal. They're different. And that diversity of possibility gives us enormous potential if we want to work together. And it also gives us great power if those times when we have to work alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with many of these processes, group energy does come in here, so that group energy can help to boost whatever it is you're doing and wherever it is you're going. But then there are times where you need to have the solitude in order to fine-tune it all. So I was blown away by the fact that, among other things, that his school of Thelma was actually channeled philosophy through his wife Rose. Is
yeah,
that what
it's not Thelma, Barbara. It's Thelema. Thelema is the Greek,
okay.
is the Greek word. Yeah, it's the Greek word for
will.
Well,
that sounds prettier.
So yeah, exactly, Thelema. It's not a girl's name. Funnily enough,
yeah.
You're the first person I've heard since the FBI to get that wrong. So you're in good, interesting company. No, he had a group of followers in California in the 1940s and 30s, and they were busted at one point by the FBI, and the FBI report, which you can Freedom of Information says, referred to them as the Church of Thelma. I used to know a lady called Thelma. I wondered what she had to do with it. So it's Thelema. It's Thelema, which is a very important word in Crowley's system. Thelema is will, and it has a gematrian number, which is 93, which is the same as love in Greek, agape. So will and
uh-huh.
love are identified in the system. which brings us into sort of our period.
I don't know as much about him as you do, but he came across as somebody who was bordering on brilliant and not fitting into society
very
well.
He's over the border, I think.
He's
over the border. He's clearly a genius.
But,
I wouldn't have spent so much of my time with his work if I'd thought any less. You know, there are interesting writers on the subject, you know, but there's masters.
But he's been so ill-treated over the last couple of decades. It just, and I'm not telling anyone that they should follow his whatever. I think it's important that people actually do their own research and learn about him from his own words, among other things. And that's what's so amazing. You quote from his diary so often, and it's so obvious that he was so intent on reaching certain levels and on achieving certain things. And he always came up almost always having achieved it and yet finding it wanting and needing to, to go further and find more. And So in a way, his life had to be slightly frustrating because he did achieve that oneness once or more than once. I couldn't really kind of pin it down as to how often he actually felt that oneness and that bliss of being the light.
Yeah, it occurred after a great deal of effort, first of all in late 1906.
Mm-hmm.
So he was then 31, wasn't he? So it was just before his 31st birthday, interestingly. But he found that after once he'd achieved what is called in the yoga system samadhi, in Hindu samadhi, which is slightly different to Buddhist samadhi. Samadhi being union with God, frankly. That's the only translation you can come up with. But the use of the word God in these things is problematic because people can't agree on it, fight over the meaning of it. But it is a union with the highest, or what he would say was the holy guardian angel. And he used that expression, he said, because a child could understand it. So,
well, he didn't dabble in anything.
He was no dabbler.
No, he plunged full head in the deep end anywhere he went.
Barbara, you see, what it is, I just want to make this clear because it's so misunderstood. Is that he was a researcher into consciousness, and that is pioneering work. It's consciousness research. It should be remembered that he was a Cambridge scholar, a University of Cambridge. He wasn't playing at it. He wasn't an amateur. He wanted to take spiritual and metaphysical issues onto the same level as Einstein took Newtonian physics. That's the kind of level you're talking at, and which is why was so threatening, I think, to religious authority then and probably now, because he wanted to find the factual basis of all the religions so that it could be made available for every person to seek that union themselves. And this was threatening, of course, to organized religion, which always puts something between you and God, namely the preacher or the book or the system, or the consciousness of sin, or all these sorts of things. So he was a real pioneer.
Oh gosh, yeah. And where did it start? I mean, I certainly when he was in school, he was pulling away from traditional Christianity. And
his father was an independently wealthy preacher of exclusive fundamentalist religion. I mean, he would have given, he would have probably made Billy Graham feel that he didn't know his Bible quite well enough, his father. He was quite an extraordinary character, his father. And he used to take his son with him, and he'd sort of, he'd meet men on the road, and he'd say things like, this is Crowley's father, so things, what are you going to do after you've been digging the road? And they said, well, I'll probably go home. And he said, well, what are you going to do then? And he'd take them through this until they finally got to the end of their lives. He'd say, and what are you going to do then? And by which time they were enthralled. And he'd invite them to a meeting. And he always spoke very quietly and with no fuss at all. So Crowley knew how to evangelize. He knew the evangelical system. And he knew, as he said, how easy it was to get a crowd worked up into a state, you know, where they thought they were being touched by the Holy Spirit or what have you. He went to see Billy Sunday, the American evangelist, when he lived in America for 5 years, 1914-1919. And he said, my father could have done this much easier and with a considerably less noise. So he had a fundamentalist Christian upbringing, was brought up to believe that every single word of the Bible was the absolute utterance of God himself, without barely an intermediary. Apparently the prophets simply wrote down from direct dictation. In English, you would have thought, because they particularly keen on the King James Bible. So he knew what Christianity was, root and branch. He'd got that sorted. But he found that after his father died when he was 12 years old, and he came under the care of his uncle, who was also an evangelical, but much more bigoted than even his father. And his mother also had a very warped idea of religion and how to bring up a child. They sent him to a dreadful school where he was persecuted. And Crowley started rebelling. And as he'd heard so much about the Book of Revelation and the beast and all this sort of stuff, his mother caught him doing something at some point, and she said, you know, you're the beast, you know. And he said, all right, I'm the beast. And that sort of name stuck, because somebody once said to him, why do you call yourself the beast? And he said, well, my mother called me the beast. So that, you've got to understand that spirit. And as he'd read that the beast was going to come at a certain point and see the end of the kind of Christianity which was torturing him, he was quite happy to go along with it. He didn't mind being the beast. If he could end the system of moral and spiritual torture to which he felt he'd been subjected by the bigotry totally unspiritual kind of belief, obsession with sin, all sex is sin, you know, sex is the weakness of mankind, it's our utter downfall without, you know, and all of that. Very much the thing that people went through in the West in the 60s and got some of it out of our system, about the utter guilt at having genitals, you know, the utter guilt at having sexual feelings. He rebelled. He said, these things which they're trying to suppress are actually vital for spiritual development. And I think that also created a great deal of opposition. We're talking about before the First World War. We're talking about Amy Semple Thurston kind of time. And, you know, if you imagine what your great-great-great-grandmother was taught, you know, in terms of how to live and what to wear. And you know, that's what he was rebelling against. And, of course, now the whole culture's rebelled against that. We haven't got it right. We don't understand what he meant by the spiritualization of sex. For him, sex was a spiritual means of uniting oneself with the spiritual world par excellence. And he hated what he called filth. Well, he would always call it filth if people were just going for kicks, you know, pure physical stimulus. He called that filth. For him, the ecstasy of the sexual moment was religious. And he wasn't kidding about that. He wasn't saying it's like religion. For him, it was.
He did things that appeared to be impulsive, and yet they didn't seem impulsive at all. I mean, I can't remember how long, but he only knew his wife for a number of weeks before they married.
Oh, I think it may have been less than that, in actual fact. Yes. Well, she was in trouble. She was the sister. No, I don't mean that way. She was the sister of. He loved stories of knights who rescued ladies, this sort of thing. He'd been brought up on Arthurian literature, and the Holy Grail and that stuff like that. And his wife to be Rose was in fact his one of his best friend's sisters, but she was quite a, you'd say, wayward lady. She'd been married already. Her husband had died in South Africa. She was involved with two men, one of whom she'd promised to marry, but she realized was a great mistake, and she was trying to get out of that. And then there was another guy she thought she wanted to go off with, but she wasn't sure about that. Anyway, she confided in Alistair, her brother's friend, and he said, look, I'll get you out of this. We'll get married, and then you can go and do what you like.
Oh,
he said, don't worry, we'll go up to the registrar. He was living in Scotland at the time. We'll go up to the registrar, get married, so that'll deal with the person who thinks he wants to marry you, so he'll go off, and you can go off with the friend that you really fancy. And she said, all right. They went and got married, and they found within a week they were madly in love with each other. It's quite a great story, really. Make a good film, that story alone. So,
absolutely.
And she then became... She turned out she had clairaudient capacities. She had an ability to hear, you know, beyond the normal.
Uh-huh.
And it was she who got him into the whole adventure in Cairo. That after he'd been in India, he met her. Then they went back to India together for their honeymoon in Sri Lanka. And on the way back to Cairo, he had this amazing experience in 1904. And where he received what has since been called the Book of the Law, which is the sort of cornerstone of Crowleyan ethics. And quite incredible. I mean, it was his wife who got him going on that. She said, they're waiting for you. They are waiting for you. Quite. And he said, he being very skeptical, philosophical, intellectual type, just said, you know, pull the other one. You know, you must be joking. What are you talking about? They're waiting for you. She says, no, come with me, come with me. And there's this wonderful story of how she got him finally to think. He did all sorts of tests to check whether she was kidding herself or him, and he was amazed by that something was happening. Something was really going on there.
I'm so impressed by all that he did in his search. I mean, usually. Now you can get online and you can look at stuff, but that was not the case in the late 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, he was thoroughly, I'm not sure how far he went into theosophy, but he certainly studied it quite a bit.
He respected Helena Blavatsky, but he wasn't too keen on her followers. And he met, actually, when he was coming back from Cairo, he met Annie Besant on the ship going back to England, and they had a chat. He saw himself and came to see himself, certainly by the 20s and really before that, as the successor of Blavatsky. He felt Blavatsky had started something, but her followers didn't know where to take it because he felt they didn't have the authority. And of course, the Theosophical Society split up into all different groups. I think things now in the Theosophical Order are a lot friendlier, and I think there's over the century and more there's more openness nowadays. But there's still this absolutely super emphasis on Indian religion, whereas Crowley was very also interested in what we call the Western esoteric tradition. But he wanted to unite the West and the East, and he didn't think the Theosophical system quite understood how that could be done. He thought that the people were too ready to confuse Nirvana, for example, the Buddhist idea of Nirvana, with the Christian heaven, and they presented a kind of sentimental view of Buddhism. And he studied, as you see, if you read my book, you'll see he really went to the root of Buddhism. He wanted to know whatever Buddha knew, he wanted to know it inside out.
I think that what impressed me tremendously was, especially when he got into the Eastern modalities, the element of meditation was crucial. And in what I've experienced today and over the last 50 years is the element of meditation has become more and more and more acknowledged and accepted as a form of putting yourself on that journey towards cosmic consciousness. And he did it to the extreme. And when you listen to what he's writing in his journals about, you know, being interrupted and getting there and interrupted and getting there and interrupted, I mean, he was this was a man of such amazing intensity. I would imagine he had a piercing sight, that his eyes would pierce right through you.
Oh, I think that's true. If he wanted to, yes. Mm-hmm. He didn't. As he went on, he didn't regale everybody he met with, you know, his belief system. If people showed an interest and was uh-huh. a serious interest, he would speak to them, and they were often astonished because they thought he was just a, you know, sporty character who liked the open air and a good laugh, because he was an incredibly funny man and was constantly pulling people's legs and telling jokes. But if he was serious, he would open up. And one of his longest standing friends, Gerald York, said that the longer you were with him, he said, you realized he was a Jivanmukta. He was a liberated spirit. And because of that, mm-hmm. when he explained something, you could go there with him. You could feel the consciousness that actually what it felt like to understand what he was referring to. He just didn't tell you something. He could open people's minds. If they were willing to have them open, of course. There are some people that don't want to open their minds. Far, far too uncomfortable an experience. They might find out how small their mind was.
Well, with all of this other material that he dealt with constantly, I mean, he was fortunate enough to be able to finance himself to do this investigation and this study and this stretching of himself. He also climbed mountains. How did he enter into this? Was the climbing of mountains another form of challenging himself, or was it sort of significant as to his journey within, with the journey without? Where did the mountain climbing come from?
Well, you're right. There is an analogy, isn't there, between going within to the depths and going to the heights physically. So that, mm-hmm. that I think, was a very healthy thing, that he balanced his inner search with living in the world and matching himself up against the highest peaks. He had the highest climbing record for anyone on a mountain for many years, which he achieved on K2, which any serious mountaineer today will tell you is actually in many ways more difficult a mountain to climb than Everest. But they did it without oxygen. Where did it come from? He was bullied at school terribly. And he had stomach problems and kidney problems. And when the kids at the school found out about it, they'd kick him in his stomach or in his kidneys to cause him grief. And he nearly died. And so he met a very famous British doctor called Dr. Lister, who invented the whole thing about didn't invent it, but developed the whole thing about cleanliness in hospitals and diseases were being spread by bacteria. And Lister, very fair. Anyway, Lister took him on walks into the highlands of Scotland, and he started to get healthier. And the more he did it, the better he felt. And by the 1890s, early 1890s, he was one of the greatest climbers in England already. And then he went to the Alps. He climbed the Eiger single-handed when he was about 18. You know, I mean, they made movies about Clint Eastwood climbing, you know, with all this equipment. He went up without ropes on his own. You know, he was amazing. And then he was best friends with the best climber in England, which was Oscar Eckenstein. And together they said, right, well, let's do Mexico. So in 1900, he went to Mexico with Eckenstein and spent 1900 to 1901 climbing the highest peaks in Mexico. And then they said, well, next year, let's do the bigger one we can find, the best. And they went for K2. And the 1902 expedition to K2 was a totally pioneering, first time a full attempt had ever been made on K2. And had they not had the most extraordinarily bad weather, I mean, he was stuck up on the mountain for days and days and days, stuck in baby. Well, you wouldn't even put a person in these tents these days. The conditions were so bad. But they got the highest climbing record. And then 3 years later, he went to Kangchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain in India. And they nearly got that as well. And that's on the Sikkim-Nepali border. And you can see it from Darjeeling in the distance. But it's the five peaks. But it had never been attempted seriously before. And I don't think it was climbed anyway until the mid-50s. And this was, he was climbing 50 years ago. So he's a great guy. He then went to New York in 1906 and tried to get money to go back to the Himalayas because he said there's great possibilities for exploring and for nature, for gathering rare plants and making tests about all sorts of scientific tests, which he included in the regimen. And nobody in New York was interested. Absolutely nobody. They just thought mountaineering was ludicrous. There's no interest. He couldn't get any interest at all to get another expedition. But every time he got a bit flabby, which he did because he enjoyed his food, he'd go off mountaineering or he walked across the deserts in North Africa. He was quite a man. I mean, physically he was strong, and it wasn't somebody who easily messed with him. And yet he had also a very feminine nature as well.
Just out of curiosity, is that Dr. Lister at all connected to Listerine?
Yes, that's the origin of Listerine. Yes, I think so.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to think of the basic term for it. It's basically about hygiene in hospitals. There's a particular word for it as a complete study. It's that whole thing about. Anyway, he knew Listerine.
Wow.
He also knew Dr. Moore. He knew Dr. Maudsley, who was one of the great founders of psychiatry in England. The Maudsley Hospital is still going. He knew the top scientists. He knew the top scientists of the world when he was in Berlin in 1930-31. He knew Einstein and Schrödinger. You know, he was no onion. He wasn't like some sort of New Age freak who, in the sense of somebody who escaped from science by delving into magic, which is always the way people particularize. People are interested in spiritual, so-called occultism or magic. His whole interest was knowledge per se. But he was particularly interested in consciousness. And of course, nowadays consciousness research is one of the cutting edge areas of psychology and science generally. What is the mind? Is there a limit to mind?
Well, so actually, he really was an anachronism, and
he's out on his own.
It's just it blows your mind. He also has was it typhus that he had? Yeah, what he caught cholera?
He had malaria. He got malaria.
Malaria.
Yeah, malaria was
okay.
Malaria, which was most people who went to the Far East in those days were almost certain to get some sort of malarial infection. But the trouble with malaria, as you may know, is it comes back at different times in your life, even if you're not there, as it were. I mean, it comes from a mosquito injecting the stuff into you. So he did suffer a bit there. The worst thing he suffered from was bronchitis and asthma. That was his biggest suffering in his whole life. And that's why he first took heroin, which was recommended by his doctor, Dr. Batty Shaw of Harley Street, London. The only definite amelioration for serious asthma in those days was to give people heroin, can you imagine? So they became addicted.
And a lot of the things that he partook of, the hashish, the cocaine, the heroin, the laudanum, they were all accepted substances at that time. They weren't outlawed or anything like that, I don't believe.
That's true. He used to get them from the pharmacist. You could go to Winneray, EP Winneray's in London, and pick up your stuff. It was a respectable shop in Piccadilly.
Well, it just seems to me that, they go to the fact that he was a drug addict. Yes and no. I mean, he utilized these at a time when they were not outlawed. he utilized them for health and for exploration of consciousness. But it wasn't like he was a junkie on the street corner. He was utilizing them to get somewhere. And I don't recommend that approach for people. But during that time frame, it was an accepted use.
He got into some trouble with heroin later on. He got into some trouble later on with heroin, and it took him about a year or two to get off it completely, which he did by effort of will. And because of his asthma, it was the best. Excuse me, somebody's just saying. Sorry, I'm very busy at the moment. All right. He got off by effort of will. He went through a period in 1922 when he took too much cocaine, and I think that led to about sort of a few months of sort of fairly mad goings on. But again, he got off it, and he didn't bother with it afterwards. I think he says in his diary in 1924, these things are just emergency rations, and But when it came to the psychedelics, which is mescaline, he was one of the first people to experiment with peyote in a period when nobody had even heard of it. I mean, long before R. Gordon Wasson and all that, before he ever heard of Carlos Castaneda, long, long before. He'd experimented with peyote, as now called mescaline, the mescal. And he always took it heavily diluted, and he was very careful with the measurements, and he would record them scientifically, how much it would take, whether it would have an effect or not. I mean,
I'm curious, did he ever experiment with ayahuasca?
No, I don't think so. I think he would have been interested for sure. I don't think it was there was a market for that at the time.
Well, there's actually no market for it now. You have to, you know, go to the source, so to speak.
I don't think it was particularly available. I think peyote was sufficient. I think people who've taken ayahuasca anyway today. The trouble with ayahuasca, as I understand it, is there's a very, very great degree of loss of control. In other words, you can't handle the visions. You've got to go with them, or you know, they're overpowering.
I understand.
So they're problematic in that way. And I don't think you'd have enjoyed throwing up and all that.
No. Well, I do remember seeing in his diary that you have in the book, you know, five drops here, three drops here, you know, being very conscious of the effects of it. I want to go back just a second because you got me past the mountaineering. In your book, you have pictures of the tents, pictures of the camps. I mean, when you see it, you think, oh, my God, why would anybody voluntarily punish themselves like this? I mean, they had, I think at one point you said that, you know, there were three or four men that were on the expedition and that there were 70 helpers that you know, carried the material
the
that they were going to be taking. And pictures of them. I mean, my gosh, they had rags wrapped around their feet. They weren't even wearing shoes, some of them. And to think that they were, you know, jauntingly going up a mountaintop and passed over glaciers and all sorts of stuff, it boggles the mind that anyone in their right mind would do that. I mean, seriously. And yet he wrote some of the prettiest poetry, you know.
He was up on K2 in his tent in hideous winds, sort of 22,000 feet above sea level, and he was writing a poem called The Earl's Quest in his tent. It's quite amazing. The man he went up to K2 with said, "You must leave your books behind when we get to the mountain." Crowley said, "On no account will I not carry my books up that mountain." He says, "Because I will stay sane while you lot go mad."
Yes.
He said he understood that people would lose their minds on the mountain because of the scale. Is unless you've actually been up seriously on a mountain and in serious danger, that's something I have experienced, you have no can never have any idea what nature is all about when it comes to its extraordinary power and overwhelming power. He actually got a satisfaction from being overwhelmed by nature. He was not mentally overwhelmed by it, but for man to realize his, as it were, insignificance close to nature was for him a healthy experience. You know, he thought a lot of people should have that, you know. I often hear this thing today, you know, man has conquered nature. I always laugh when I hear that. We could be snuffed out in a second.
In a heartbeat.
You know, absolutely. I mean, for thousands of years, we've had to placate the gods or laws of nature with sacrifices and whatnot and prayers and hymns and please give us a new harvest and please let the sun come up tomorrow morning and so on. We now know the sun's going to come up anyway. Apparently you can still pray for rain with some success if you know what you're doing. I wonder how regularly that might work. But the fact of the matter is Crowley wanted to understand whether or not there was an intelligence in nature. This is one of the things he was interested in. And he came to the conclusion in India that nature is neither good nor bad. It's just, it is what he called fatal. There is a fatality about it. Now, meaning, several meanings of that is, one is there's a destiny. In other words, once you start off a process, it's going to go on whether you like it or not. If you set up a wave in nature, once you've set it up, it will realize itself. You know, you can't stop it once it's set up. That's the meaning of karma.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I recognize that when pregnant and hearing other women scream saying, "Well, if it hurts that much, I'm not doing it," and have somebody said to me, "You started this process. You have no choice but to finish it."
Yes, right, absolutely. Well said. Very true.
Yeah, and at the moment, at that moment, it didn't hurt that bad. But after a while, I began to realize, oh my, and the element of karma comes in here too. And you know, so many people talk about karma and it's energy, and you know, not good or bad, it's energy, and it's how you choose to utilize it or manifest it. And once you start, you're committed. And he was he was phenomenal. I mean, people should read his poetry and you'll know that there was no horrible demonology connected to this man. Couldn't possibly be.
I'd been warned off when I was a student at Oxford. Now, how many years ago? Nearly 40 years ago. It was about 40 anyway. Bored a bit. I was warned off. You know, people said, "Oh, don't mess with Crowley. You know, it's evil. You'll get all kinds of stuff." And you got all this fear was rammed into your head. And I used to suffer for my interest. I knew there was something worthwhile in it, but I'd also suffer a sort of, you know, am I wise? And the mind is very good at sending negative signals. I mean, it's like everyone's afraid of the dark if they haven't got a light. They haven't got a light switch and they're not quite sure what's in front of them. That's natural. But it wasn't until I got to grips with his private papers and diaries, which I've been very very lucky to be able to use in these books because they're unpublished. I went through page after page after page of his writings from right through his life, and never once did I have a sort of feeling of pathological insanity or the kind of mentality of a murderer or a person who wanted to harm other people, or who was, you know, mentally sick, or was, you know, had lost his mind. There was never, ever a hint. There was always a pleasing, humorous rationalism. And and he put, you know, he calmed a lot of people down. You know, you've misunderstood this, you've misunderstood. We come into this world still, in our Western culture, still parts of our thinking and our brains belong in the Middle Ages. We still
don't
need much. We still don't need a lot of encouragement to condemn somebody as satanic, to fear evil, to be afraid of the dark, to think about witches, demons, what's going to happen to us when we are we going to hell? All of that is still around, even in the scientific. You know, people drive a modern car, but they're not modern behind the eyes. You know, that takes true education and to some degree initiation. People are so afraid. You know, this is one of the things about Crowley. He was not a fearful character. He said he was cowardly, but every time he felt cowardice, he wanted to match himself up against his fear and overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason he climbed mountains, I think, was to overcome his own resistance. And that's why he went so far, I think, with things. He wanted to defeat his weakness. Now, some people said he didn't defeat his weakness, he just gave into it.
I don't believe that at all.
I think he was determined. He said fear is failure. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and, you know, with all of the different organizations that he was a part of, he didn't investigate them. He immersed himself in them. He became a part of them. Theophacy, the Blavatsky material. I do believe that was he a Mason? I think he was a Mason as well.
Yeah,
and
he did become a Mason at one point, yeah.
Yeah, and then the Society for the Golden Dawn as well. All of these organizations, he didn't just research and you know, take what he needed and whatever. He became immersed in them, he experienced them, and he took what worked for him and he moved on. And I'm impressed, amazingly impressed at his intensity and his dedication to gather what he needed for the journey that he was on.
It went on all his life, Barbara. It went on all his life. He never stopped. He never. I think one friend in the 1930s said he only ever saw him once, depressed, feeling that maybe you know he'd come to the end of the line. Only once, he said, and he very soon recovered from it. Even though he was given the most incredible. I mean, he couldn't get back to America after 1920 because J. Edgar Hoover, who was running the Bureau of Investigation, was suspicious that he was some sort of British spy. He couldn't get back to America and see his friends or carry on with his work. He was kind of stuck. He was kicked out of Italy by Mussolini. I mean, look at his record. Very interesting. He's kicked out of Italy by Mussolini. He's kicked out of France by fascist policemen. and he can't get back into America because of J. Edgar Hoover.
Good grief.
I mean, yeah, amazing, isn't it? So I always say this about Freemasonry. Look in the countries where it's banned and you'll see where the Freemasons are a good or bad thing. You know, you'll find where you can get shot for it in Iraq or Iran. You know, all the Masons were hanged when the Ayatollah came in. So where Crowley was kicked out of, look what was behind it. You know, it's very interesting.
And often it was his journey and his dedication to learning. I mean, this man just wanted to learn. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that it's a goal that most of us have. Not all of us are able to commit ourselves to the journey as he was, but still a journey nonetheless. I mean, to go into...
Everyone could do something.
Oh, sure, but I mean, come on, Buddhism, Hinduism, yoga, all of these different tools that he learned, that he stretched himself into, I would imagine they didn't warp his brain, they made it sharper. And you know, in a way, he must have, towards the end of his life, felt kind of trapped in a reality that he didn't feel he really belonged in anymore.
Yeah, I think yes and no to that. Certainly, insofar as he was constantly having to deal with the average mind, and which very shows very little interest of expanding and a lot of interest in fact losing what little there is. Most people we all waste our minds in all sorts of ways at various points, and that often we're encouraged to do so. We prefer entertainment to enter attainment, as I call it. We want to enter something to attain, but it's much easier to be distracted. And it's easy to rule people, of course, who are completely distracted. So it's in the interests of government to keep people in a state of sort of suspended animation. And, you know, it's Crowley loved life, though. He did love life. He said it's damned hard to get any true joy out of this life, but it's not impossible. He said of Buddha, you know, he said Buddha was cured of the universal sorrow when he went out for a drink with the universal joke. Okay. That's very Crowley. Because anyone who thinks about life can very quickly succumb to what he called the trance of sorrow. Oh God, everyone's going to die. Isn't it miserable? All good things come to an end. Great things are disparate. John Lennon was murdered. Mahatma Gandhi shot, etc., etc. You know, there's no hope. What's the point? We can all succumb to this trance of sorrow. And he said, well, yes, it is miserable, but it is not impossible to enjoy yourself. So it's not all black. And white magic is grabbing onto the white part, the potential of man, to draw back the shadows of our fears and improve our lives. And if you think of the benefits of science as well as the dangers, but if you think of the benefits of science and how all our lives have become brighter, even though, uh-huh, you know, we got used to a lot of it now, but there are so many things. People, you know, not very long ago, you had to go to bed at, you know, when the sun went down because you probably didn't have enough money to pay for an oil lamp. You had to get up with the sun. Things were tough. Now, things are easier now, and people could have more time to develop their inner life. But what do they do? No, they call it leisure time. So any time when they're not working, they just want to be playing. Well, play is very important, but it is developing your spirit and coming to know yourself.
What,
if we gave as much
his...
time to that as we do to entertainment, we'd have a wiser world, wouldn't we? And we'd be less prone to expect politicians to do all our dreams for us.
Oh, please. right. What was, you just mentioned a trigger word for me, and that's spirit. What was his philosophy on the spirit? Did he believe in reincarnation? Did he believe in...
He said that I think his view on reincarnation overall was he personally felt that he had been through other lives, but always there was something which was unique in that life. In other words, it wasn't a complete transformation, but there was something going through it. And he relived some of these lives through deep Samasati meditations, especially when he was in America, uh-huh, in New Hampshire, and later in New York, just outside. He went, I'm trying to think, I can't remember the name of the little bit outside. It used to be a fun fair there. Anyway, there was a whatever. But he had a deep meditation and went through various lives. But he said he wouldn't insist on it as a doctrine. In other words, he wouldn't say to somebody, you must believe in reincarnation, it's true. He said it might... He was always prepared to accept it might be an inward fantasy. But for him, he felt it was true. He regarded the body as a vehicle. And when the vehicle's had enough, you leave it and you go into another vehicle. And if you're fully developed, like the Buddha, you will want to come back to Earth to help people out. Even if you're heading for the great Nirvana, you might say, uh-huh, yes, well, I'll come back and do more. And that would be a true, that is about the most noble thing you could think of, is to go through this trial of life again. So I can understand that. I personally don't have a strong view about reincarnation, but so many of people I know and have met have strong feelings about it, which I respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just up to the individual, I guess, and what they're comfortable with. Everybody has their own inner truths, and you know, I feel you have to honor those truths, and even if they aren't yours. And you know, there's no way you're going to convince somebody your method, because it's your method. And I just think that I kept trying to find where all of the stuff was that everybody talked about, and I couldn't find it. So now it's a matter of wanting to get the word out there that you know, before you follow the accusations of someone, you know, check out where they came from, do some research. Don't automatically say, oh, evil, 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 because this man had more beauty in him than anything else. He was just a very dedicated, almost fanatical person who was searching for something that he knew was there, and he was trying to find it. I wanted to ask also, I know his first child died early. His second daughter, how long did she live, and did she carry on any of his work?
No, Lola Zazar, his second daughter, became estranged from him, because when his wife Rose sadly became an alcoholic and entered dementia, and he divorced her. Because he could no longer take responsibility for her. I mean, she was just getting through too much drink. And he made an arrangement with her family, and she went to live with her family and took the daughter with her to be brought up by her mother and father. And unfortunately, her family did not like Aleister Crowley at all. And I think they and others told Lola that she was very lucky to get away from her wicked father. You see, his wife's father was a clergyman, Reverend Kelly, in Camberwell Vicarage in London. And, of course, would have obviously been quite disturbed by Crowley's not being a card-carrying Christian. So I think that was a factor. Lola, he got back in touch with Lola indirectly in the 30s when she was in her late teens, in her 20s, sorry. And a friend tried to be a mediator between them, but I saw the letter she wrote back to Gerald York, and she said, I have seen my father's books and I find them disgusting, and I don't want to know him. So she felt bitter, obviously. It's a sad thing. She died, I think, in 1993 in Reading. Lola did, and she had nothing to do, as far as I know, with any of his belief system. Yeah. I think that was one of the pains that Crowley bore very privately and never spoke to anybody about.
And he never married again.
Oh, he did. Yes, he did.
Did he?
He did, yes. He married, Maria de Miramar. Very curious. Yes, he married her because he was advised by a contact in England that he was kicked out of France. He wasn't kicked out. He had his right to be there refused, what was called a refus de séjour, because somebody had gone who became his enemy. I've seen the paperwork. And went to the Sûreté in France and accused him of, I don't know what specifically, but being a troublemaker in Paris or something. And the police came around and they found a coffee-making machine and they thought it was a distilling heroin or something. So he was accused. Yeah. So they cut short his refus de séjour, and he was also he was accused of being a German spy. That was another thing. And he was at the time living with this Nicaraguan lady, Maria de Miramar, and he was told that she could only he was told that she could only enter England if they were married. So they went to Leipzig and got married. The marriage did not last long at all. Crowley wasn't interested in bourgeois institution of marriage himself, and he presumed his wife understood that.
Those weren't the only places that he was kicked out of, though. He left rapidly. Was it China? No, China. Where
Calcutta.
Calcutta,
attacked by dacoits in Calcutta, and to defend himself against his gang, who got him in an alleyway. He had his revolver with him, and he shot one, and the bullet went into the guy behind him. They then were taken to hospital, where they confessed to attacking a Westerner in the streets of Calcutta, back streets of Calcutta. He went to a lawyer and said, "What do you think I should do?" And he then went to a very, very senior lawyer, and they said, "Well, the fact is, at the moment, the Viceroy of India is trying to prove to the Hindus that he's as severe with English and Western criminals as he is with Hindus." So he said, "What will happen is you'll get off because you're innocent, but," he said, "they'll find all sorts of legal ways to keep you coming back to court for political reasons." So Crowley thought, "Well, I can either," he said, "what's the point of going to court if I'm not going to get convicted?" So he said to his wife, who just arrived with their baby, he said, you've arrived just in time to see me hanged." And then he said, "Do you fancy? Do you want to walk across Persia, or should we do China?" And she said, "Darling, the walk will do us good. Let's go to China." So he walked across China with his wife and baby, another incredible adventure. So he wasn't kicked out of India, but he had to get out quick. He also had to get away from Berlin in 1931 because the political thing was changing. Hitler was very close to power at the time, and the Germans were getting close to realizing that he'd been a spy against the Germans in the First World War, and he had to get out of Berlin quick. an adventure.
Where did he end up?
Well, who knows? If you mean did he spend the last bit of his life? He was living in London during World War II, where he was entertaining American troops who were coming over, especially Grady McMurtry, who came from California, and it was very keen on Aleister Crowley's writings. And then he moved out to an inn. Then he spent his last couple of years. Last two years at a boarding house in Hastings in Sussex, which had been set up for old theatrical people in their old age or got hard times. And he lived in this little country house on the outskirts of Hastings, where he died of myocardial. Yeah, he died of bronchitis in the very tough winter of 1947 and was cremated in Brighton, and his ashes were taken to the Hamptons in the United States, where Carl Germer buried them under a tree in the Hamptons, and then came to dig them up because he was moving to California and couldn't find them. Now, it's very strange because Crowley in 1907 had written a poem called The Poet, and the line was, "Bury me in a nameless grave. I came from God the world to save." And in fact, his grave is nameless. Nobody knows what happened to the ashes. But they were deposited in the United States, which is very interesting, I think.
No, I just am in awe of, first of all, the journey he was on. And secondly, I mean, his family money financed a lot of it, and then his poetry financed a lot of it too.
Would have been nice if his poetry. No, his poetry didn't finance it. His poetry cost him his fortune because he had all his poems before the First World War. He paid for to be published in beautiful bindings, following the example of William Morris and the Kelmscott Press, and they were all beautiful productions which he paid for. He had Zehnsdorf do the binding and the design. And he lost by 1913, just before the First World War. All he had was his house in Scotland, his estate, which was heavily mortgaged, and which he lost that during the war. So by 1920, he was practically penniless. And he went on for the next 27 years 27 years in very great financial problems and still didn't give it. The only job he ever had where anyone paid him was a job running a magazine in New York in 1917, 1918.
Wow. But he's, you know, the thing is, what happened to the organization that he created?
That's still going. Still going.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there are two aspects to it. There are two aspects to his organization. There's the Ordo Templi Orientis, which was founded by an Austrian and two Germans, and that was founded as an idea in the 1890s, early 1900s, but it doesn't become anything until Crowley starts writing the rituals beginning in 1912. And then it starts, and that's more the social organization. That's run from New York today, Ordo Templi Orientis. The other organization was the teaching organization, which is Astrum Argentium, Order of the Silver Star, which is purely for teaching, and there's no social aspect to it at all. He didn't want a social aspect because he said that's what happened to the Golden Dawn, is people stop getting jealous of each other and infighting and sects split and all this. The AA is you're taught from one to another, directly between one person and another, you know, and it's not about getting badges or certificates. You've got to actually do the work. So I think the take-up of that is relatively small.
Well, the rituals that were involved, are they meditative type of rituals? Are they, what kind of rituals were they connected to?
Well, the Ordo Templi Orientis still performs what's called the Gnostic Mass, which was the name Crowley gave to a piece of writing he put together in Moscow in 1913, before the Russian Revolution, and it has aspects of Masonry in it. The Ordo Templi Orientis is basically a Masonic order that's been developed in the way that the ancient and accepted rite is regular Masonry, but developed to 33 degrees. The people who founded the Ordo Templi Orientis wanted to set up a Masonic academy, which would include all degrees possible within the whole Masonic system, and then some extras as well. So the Gnostic Mass is formed. Now, other than that, that's the only ritual in formal terms that's performed in the Ordo Templi Orientis, which is, you know, a systematic ritual, takes a certain amount of time to produce. Other than that, the ritual magic, if you want to learn that, it tends to be done in a solitary manner by the individual. So there are many, many books by Crowley for performing certain rites, which are highly, mostly based on internal meditative practices.
And just for those who I have found of late that terms that I understand and as far as I think I do, there are words that are thrown around that I don't think people understand what they mean, and gnosis is one of them. And
gnosis.
You want to
gnosis?
Yeah. People use the term but don't know what it means. So can you kind of expand upon that so people will know what we're talking about?
Yeah. A Gnostic is somebody who takes the path of gnosis. Gnosis is a Greek word, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis. It's the origin of our word knowledge. If you think of our English word knowledge, K is the same as the Greek gamma. So we have, why is knowledge spelt with a K at the beginning? Because it's based on the Greek gn sound, like that, which is, can you hear that? Gnosis, like that. Okay. So that's how we get knowledge, right? So it means knowledge. And it can mean knowledge of in the ordinary sense of knowledge of facts or information, but it's particularly what you call spiritual knowledge, which is a direct engagement of the self or the soul with a spiritual truth. So it's a transformative, liberating, spiritually liberating form of knowledge. And it is that which wakes up a person from being bound to the world and the material dimension, and an awakening to the spiritual nature of the person. We talk a lot about spirituality and spiritual, but I don't think we're very clear about this at all, which is one of the reasons I've written
exactly.
A lot of my books are exactly to put this, to make this very clear, what we're talking about, spiritual knowledge. You have a spiritual knowledge tradition in every religion. There is, in Hinduism, you have what's called Jnana, same root again, J-N, Jn, like K-N or G-N, Jnana Yoga, which is the spiritual knowledge direction of yoga. You have Zen in Buddhism. Zen, again, is about an awakening, and about a specific awakening of the spiritual being of the person. In Judaism, you have Kabbalah, which is the spiritual tradition which has been received and passed down, as it were, in secret or discreetly, esoteric in that sense. In other words, it's there if you're ready to receive it, but if you're not, it isn't there. And you have it in Hermetism. In paganism, you have Hermetic Gnosis in the Hermetic tradition. And you have it in Islam with Sufism, the Sufis, who believe in the Al-Fana, the passing away of the ego, and the spiritual realization of, and the word they have is Marifa, which is the Arabic word for knowledge of a spiritual kind. So all the religions have this Gnostic side to them, but all the authoritarian aspects of the religion have always suppressed it. They don't like it because a person who has spiritual gnosis doesn't need the priest, the imam, the bishop, you see, or the rabbi. You've found the essence. If you've got to a stage of gnosis, you're already in the fraternity. You can't be taken. It's a spiritual thing. You don't need to wear a badge. You don't need to wear silly clothes. You don't have to wear a hat. You don't have to have your hair cut in a particular way. You don't have to go around saying, I'm a member of this. It's something inward. And you'd be wise to keep it quiet. Say nothing about it. And live it. Live it out. Live out the consequences of this gnosis, the spiritual knowledge you have. You don't need to shout the cause of it. And you must never be foolish enough to think that you can talk somebody else into it. As Crowley once wrote, he said, talking to a man about mysticism is like making him drunk.
A person must have
a thirst and a hunger for it, and find it for themselves. If they want it handed on a plate, they're not going to get anything, because you're not talking about a material thing, and it isn't simply facts. There are ideas connected with it, but understanding those ideas is very different to speaking about them. I know this because I studied theology, and in theology we talk a great deal about God and Christ and all the rest of it, but we generally speaking, the level of understanding is very poor. But you've got to start somewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think what gets in the way most often is that people, you know, they are looking for the way instead of their way. And,
yes, I think,
you know,
that's
correct. So, you know, it's kind of like, I know the way, follow me. Well, you know, you don't really know where you're going. So how can you lead anybody anywhere?
Yeah, right. Right, right. In the Gnostic writings, one of the phrases attributed to what they call the living Jesus is knock upon yourself as a door.
Beautiful. And that's what frustrates so many people. It's like, you know, you say go within, you say find it myself. I don't know where to look, and it's kind of like you have to ask the question and answer it yourself. There's no way someone can tell you what to do. Often it's, a tool to find that way is meditation. Find a form of meditation that will help to lead you where you need to go. But that's work, and people don't really today like to work.
No, well, and if you don't work, you become atrophied your muscles. The mind is a muscle. It needs exercise. And it's all very well getting building up in the gym. You can do the vehicle some benefit, but what's the vehicle for? What is it? What is the body the temple of? So if you do work, if you don't work on the spirit, the rest of it is purely it's like being a packet with nothing in it, a glass with no wine, a book with no pages, a man with no soul. Mm-hmm.
Beautifully put. So this journey of yours has taken you to write a gazillion books.
Not that many.
It looks like that many when you see them listed, and you know, all focusing on this same philosophy. I think you know, there are a number of them on Crowley, And you know, oh, I love this. You've got a Gurudev book too. Again, spiritual magicians. I think that people just don't understand that magic and magician can deal with intuition, can deal with inspiration, can deal with all sorts of you know, clairaudience, clairsentience, all of the clairs. And it's involved with dowsing and scrying and, I mean, all sorts of wonderful tools are connected to it the more you get into yourself and the more that you investigate what it is,
there
you
is
know,
a path,
your
yeah,
journey.
Yeah. There is a path for everybody. There is a path for everybody if they wish to, you know, that is consistent, that is in line with the gifts you've been given. That's Crowley's watchword. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Not do as thou wilt, do as you like. But find your true will and do it with your whole being. You know?
Well, I think what...
Or as they used to say, do your thing.
Yes.
Find your thing and do it. You know? Isaac Hayes,
well,
do your thing, man.
So very true. And so much of what he did is so appropriate for today for the individual. And, you know, I don't say anybody has to replicate his journey because that would be impossible. But so much more is available today for people. I mean, it's been made so much easier for us because there is so much that is so easily available, but it's a matter of taking the time to practice and to pursue it. And
the internet is a shop window, but looking in the window and actually doing something are two very different things.
It is, and I feel today that we aren't set up to commit ourselves to a lot of the study as he did. I mean, like I said, he jumped in the deep end, you know, feet first, and immersed himself in it, and became to, I guess it's sort of like when he had absorbed so much that he knew he had to look for some other way to know himself better, and each of these organizations and societies opened another door for him, another portal, if you will, to a higher consciousness, and
yes, it
appears that he constantly was seeking, though. That he never said, "I have arrived."
Oh gosh, no! You know, somebody once said, "Yeah, he was in a room once with somebody he knew, and this man referred to him, says, "Well, master," said the man to Crowley, and he said, Crowley looked around, he said, "I see no masters here."
Yeah.
There's a
well, the
nice
joy of it all.
Meanings.
I think the joy of it all. Is that once you feel you have arrived somewhere, you realize you have just gone back to square one for another journey. And
very true.
Every
That's
time,
like T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, and every time in the time that I have been on this journey, every time I kind of sit back and say, "Well, let's try to put this together and make sense of it," I find that my puzzle has not got enough pieces. And I have to keep going and looking for more pieces to fill in the puzzle. And the puzzle will never be complete until I pass on. And maybe then it'll be left incomplete too. So it's a matter of looking for your puzzle pieces in many different places, in many different ways. And quite often they come in unexpected packages. And he had such a joy of learning, such an intensity about, you know, where he was going with his searching, that it amazed me. And then he would take breaks, and he would climb a mountain or two, or seclude himself to write more poetry,
yeah.
Or fall in love,
and
or
fall
out
in
of
love.
Love.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
he was not possessive.
No, and he had.
That was one of the great things about him, really. He didn't try and possess these women, you know, that he met. He had some remarkable affairs, and he sometimes even attributed his books to them. You can't
mm-hmm.
imagine many writers doing that. And
no.
In a way, you know, he studied. Well, he would study also through his relationships. That was another way he would learn. You know, and some of these women didn't want to let him go. This was the thing. He wouldn't let him go.
Well,
he would have to remind them.
He was from just what I've read of him through your book. He was very charismatic.
Yes.
You know, in some ways, almost Rasputinous. Although Rasputin had a dark way of doing things, but there was power there, and I think there's power here. But it's not power to manipulate; it's power to expand. And I think that's what people miss is that he wasn't out to control anyone or anything except himself, as best he could.
Yeah, I mean,
and
people have said Crowley believes in a master race, you know, and they immediately think of the SS, Hitler, and this sort of thing. No,
mm-hmm.
his master race is a people who've mastered themselves. You know, that's the mastery. He hated Hitler. Hitler's whole concept, because Hitler, like all these dictators, wants imitations of himself. He wants people to surrender their knowledge of their own will. He wants them to give that up, you know, to identify themselves with the flag and all the rest of it. You know, in Crowley, you are the individual is the sovereign, and anyone who rules only as an expression of the individuality of a person. There is a political dimension to the Crowleyan doctrine which has hardly been explored and is very difficult to work out in practice for obvious reasons, given the nature of the political process as we understand it. But he was a bit like John Lennon, who said, I think John Lennon said, if somebody, whether they're from the left or whether they're from the right, says, you know, we have the power and this sort of thing, or give me your power, he said, no, you have the power. You have the power. You don't give it. Don't have to give it to these people who want it.
Yeah.
You know, when they recognize your power fully for what it is, and serve every individual, the cause of the individual, then they are entitled to some support. But so long as somebody tries to impose their will upon other people, they are not doing the Thelemite good work, which is the realization of the individual will, the fullest realization. You know, not everyone's going to make that. We know that. As some people are quite happy to take up a service role. But everyone, you know, everyone will find their true will, whatever it might be. If it's serving, it's serving. If it's writing books, or whether it's working, making clothes, or whatever it is, you can find through. Everything you do is a medium for self-understanding. It doesn't have to necessarily relate to it directly. You can learn infinite things from walking down the street if you concentrate on it in a particular way and become more aware of what you're doing. Everything is a teacher, really. The world is a book. That's what they used to, the old mystics talked about, the Liber Mundi, the book of the world. when you get the idea that everything has a capacity to reveal to you. It always helps if it's not too noisy, of course.
Yes. He set up a school, and what was he teaching in the school, or his philosophy? Was he teaching methods to seek? Was he teaching,
in the book, you've got a whole thing about what he actually taught people. A large part of it was the stages of yoga towards samadhi. That was the main thing, because he identified samadhi, union with the highest, with what the old magicians called the knowledge and conversation of the holy guardian angel. So once you were in touch with your true will, as a lovely expression, the true will, as opposed to the mere willfulness or wanting or desires that people have, once you're in touch with that, you can then become your self-teacher. So that's the main method. And not everybody wants to do ceremonial magic and focus their will through evoking or invoking powers from their subconscious, whatever that might mean. Some people will find their true will through designing aeroplanes and serving in that way. You know, so the teaching is to get you going. His teaching methods were to set people on the path. He didn't want people who clung to him. I think this is often the case of a true spiritual master. He's true spiritual master is usually saying something like, look, get away and do it. Stop bothering me. You know, you've got more power than you realize. Keep a book. Tell me what you're doing. He would ask them to keep what he called the magical diary, and they would record their practices honestly and their dreams and where they thought their spirit was heading and what they'd actually achieved in terms of yoga. And he would then write comments about it, of how they might improve it, or whether he thought they were perhaps had got the wrong idea and things like this. So he would try to gut. But, you know, I'm going to put this simply, and I much more than this, and I think your audience will be exhausted. He had what he called the concise compendium of initiated instruction in yoga, and it goes like this. Sit down, shut up, stop thinking, get out.
Perfect.
Good way to go out, don't you think, on this conversation?
I would say so. I would say so. I do want to touch a little bit about how all the negative philosophies out there began, because I think it's important for people to understand how those rumors of negative nature hit and have been, and of course every, you
could
know.
Barbara, could we save that for another conversation?
We absolutely can. And I think that you're right that that was a perfect way to end the interview, because he was an amazing man. And I just want people to give it a chance and check out his poetry, his books, his journey, and understand that there was a great deal of positive energy here, and it was not a negative journey at all. And I want to thank you so much for being here, because I've been very much looking forward to this, and hopefully I can get you back again sometime soon.
It'd be a great pleasure. Yes, I'd love to talk to you again. Yes.
Okay,
it's an endlessly interesting subject, but you know you have too much of anything.
Yes, I don't want to overwhelm them. I want to make them curious and go out and investigate for themselves.
Yeah.
I certainly hope so. And on that note, I want to thank everybody for listening. I look forward to your coming back again and being here tomorrow night and then next Monday and Tuesday. Mark and I look forward to stretching your minds and hopefully enlightening you to a certain degree or a great degree, or make you curious so that you start a journey of your own. That said, thanks for listening, everybody, Good night.